Bill Alcoholic. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me up here, Deborah and all the troops, my host Brian. Jesus, you people have nice weather up here. This is a pretty city. I told my wife, I called her Friday night and I said, "You screwed up, you should have come." This has been really nice. You know, it always cracks me up when we read the original form of chapter 5 and everybody laughs like how ridiculous that is. Boy, that would have been a mistake if they'd have printed that. We'd all be dead now. You know? And what you have there is an insight into what was really going on. You want to read something gnarly? Read the Akron Manual that was written by Bob and some of the boys in 41. I mean, you got to realize who started this thing. He says in the first edition, the first 100 of us, there were only 77. He rounded up by a third. And most of them drank. You know? Most of the people in the stories in the first edition drank. Several of them committed suicide. You know? And there's a movement around AA to go back to basics. There's your basics. You know? And these guys were badass. You know, sweet Dr. Bob. And I mean, they would go into the hospitals, you know, and they'd go from bed to bed and they'd say, "You want to quit drinking?" The guy said, "No." They'd move on until they found somebody desperate enough to listen to what they had to say. Clarence Snyder claimed in Cleveland, he claimed a 90% success rate. You know how he did it? For 3 to 4 months after you got out of the hospital, before they would let you into the AA meeting, you had to work the steps. You were visited by 4 or 5 AA guys every day before they would let you into the AA meeting. So they weeded out the weaklings before they ever made it to the meeting. Back to basics. Back to basics. There are no real issues in Alcoholics Anonymous, so we have to keep recycling the same old tired ones. You know, it's like the drug addict thing. I mean, the drug addicts have been destroying Alcoholics Anonymous since 1935. You know? Any minute now, we're going to collapse under the sheer weight of the crackheads. You know? It's just going to fall. And you can pick them out. They're all in the back of the room. You can see them. They're just a little bit sleazier than the rest of us. You know? Hiding out in AA. A few years ago, there was an NA convention in Tehran, Iran. And because you can't have AA in Iran because it's a Muslim state and there's no alcohol, therefore there's no alcoholism. So AA is not allowed. But NA, you can have NA because evidently drugs are illegal, but they're not immoral. So they had this NA convention. 12,000 people showed up. The only convention in the U.S. that's bigger than that is Founders Day. Now, do you suppose there's some alcoholics hiding out in the NA meetings in Tehran? Any minute, NA is going to collapse from this. I mean, AA shouldn't work at all. Rule number one in Alcoholics Anonymous. If there's any rules at all, this certainly is one. Everyone gets to come. Yeah. Now that shouldn't work because you and I both know that there's some people that should be weeded out of this thing. You can pretty much pick them out. You know the ones that are incorrectly alcoholic. They wanted to increase membership, so they took out honest desire to stop drinking, you know. That was a marketing move. Those are just my opinions, but they're really good ones. The way AA handles singleness of purpose is brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. There's some people that are saying that we've lost our edge, that we used to have a 75% success rate and now it's less than 5. Or however they want to make up the statistics that they don't understand anyway. And the way we handle it is if you have some weird, fringy problem, we say start your own group. You can have our book, you can have our traditions, you can take the steps, you can do whatever you want. And now there's over 300 12-step groups, organizations. 300. When they came up with Codependence Anonymous, they came up with one that every living human being qualifies for. You know? So now everybody can work the steps. You know? That's how we deal with it. You go ahead and start your own little fringe group, you know, and I think it works really well. I think you have to consider that when you look at the growth or the not growth, however, whatever your leaning is. Look at the growth of recovery around the world, of just recovery in general. That came from us. Everyone wants to get born again. Here we are. This is what it looks like. It's us, you know. We've been born again. We've been awakened. Some years ago, I was sitting with this pretty big-time Indian guru, and he was giving a talk here in the U.S., and a friend of mine was connected with him, and so after his talk, we went in the back room, and we were just sitting talking with this man, really interesting man. And he looked at me, I'm talking away like I do, and he looked at me, and he started laughing. And I said, "What are you laughing at?" And he says, "I just love you alcoholics and drug addicts." I said, "Why is that?" And he goes, "Everyone else out there is trying to get awakened. You're just trying to figure out what the hell happened." Isn't that true about us? What the hell happened? You know? I mean, that's certainly my story. What the hell happened? I was 37 years old when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was done. I was done. My sobriety date is March the 27th, 1985. You'll hear people many times, and I've actually said this myself over the years, you know, you take a cake and you've been sober a significant amount of time, and you say, "I never planned on staying here this long." You know, that was never the plan. But, you know, the truth about that, when I think back on it, if I can remember it all, I was really hoping that this would work. And I think I really hoped that I could stay here for the rest of my life, fairly early on. You know, it's like the rest of us. I didn't think I could cut it. I figured I'd probably weenie out like I've done on everything else. But I wanted to be here. And at 28 years sober, I am damn glad I'm here. You know, I mean, I've loved this thing for 28 years. I have never lost my enthusiasm for it. I have never, ever been bored in AA. And I'll tell you, if you're sitting out there tonight and you're bored, it truly is because you are boring. Because this is better than any reality TV show they'll ever make up. This is better than Swamp People, man, I tell you. Some years ago, I was sitting in my home group, and this brand new guy, really new guy, he says, he gets called on to share, and he says, "The fog is lifting, and the planes are beginning to land." Doesn't that just make the hair on the back of your neck stand up? And you know exactly what that guy's talking about, you know? Same meeting, another new guy, same meeting. Later on in the meeting, this guy gets called on and he says, "I know it's an inside job. I just don't know how to get in there." These are pearls. They're pearls. You can't make that up. Where else are you going to hear stuff like that, you know? By the time I was 17, I was a bad drunk in high school. Like most of us, you know, I started drinking when I was 14 or 15 years old. And within 2 or 3 years, it was a lifestyle. I mean, at 17, I had the big jacket, the greasy Levi's, the slouch and the sneer and the foul mouth and a bad attitude. And I carried a gun at 17. I have no idea where any of that came from. I wasn't raised by people like that at all. Matter of fact, my father was sober. My mother was really active in Al-Anon. My father got sober when I was 6 years old. I got raised in AA, on top of all my other problems. You know? I mean, there's nothing worse than living in a house with two people with clear eyes that know exactly what's going on in your head. It's just not fair. But at 17, you couldn't talk to me. I was gone. Now, today, in Alcoholics Anonymous, in this program that by some people's opinion has lost its edge somehow, the children are coming in. Have you noticed? And the little bastards refuse to leave. The children are coming now. You know? I mean, they're coming in and they're staying sober. You know? And every one of them is about as politically incorrect as you can get. You know? These are poly-addicted, depressed, bipolar aliens coming into the meetings. You know, they're being shipped here, you know, by the... Do you have them up here? Well, I figured you were shipping them all down to Southern California, you know, polluting our meetings with them, you know. My home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. It's where the men are men and the sheep are nervous. There's anywhere between 80 and 110 guys on a Monday night shoehorned into this room. And we're sober correctly there. We don't care about how your day went. If you start sharing about your girlfriend, we'll just clap till you stop. Right-wing death squad, AA. The kids started coming in. A bunch of the old guys left. They go, "Well, we're not a daycare center." You know? Like there's this illusion like they're coming because AA's so hip. My friend Scott Redmond used to say, "Alcoholics Anonymous has offered me a level of lameness that I didn't know was available." I think they're coming here because they need help. You know? But anyway, A few years ago, this kid's taking a cake, and you got to stand up at the end of the room, and it can be really intimidating because we are judging you. And, but we're not shy about that, you know. And this kid gets up there, and he's 15 years old, and he's taking a one-year cake. He gave the most right-wing AA pitch I think I've ever heard. And at the end of it, he's standing there yelling and pointing. And he says, "And if you're sitting out there and you don't have a sponsor and you're not working the steps, may God have mercy on your soul." I went up to him and asked him to be my sponsor. So the demographic is changing, isn't it? Recovery is available at all levels of our society now. It's what Bill Wilson wanted. He wanted hospitals across the country, remember? He went to Rockefeller to get the money. Rockefeller and his brilliance wouldn't give it to him. And truly, I mean, it would have destroyed, I'm convinced it would have destroyed AA. If he'd have handed Bill Wilson a couple of million bucks, and Bill and the boys, you know, we might be somewhere else this evening. And who knew better about the corruption that money can bring than John Rockefeller? But it's happened now. There's hospitals across the country. Maybe it didn't look like what he planned. Maybe it's been imperfect from time to time. You know, maybe it hasn't worked very well. But it's available now. It's part of the lexicon. It's part of our language now. We talk about recovery as much as we talk about addiction and alcoholism. There's a very, very strong movement afoot now to start legalizing stuff in order to put people in recovery rather than fill the prisons. 70% of the prisons are filled with that. I mean, there's real dialogue about this now today. I mean, it is changing. We have changed the face of the planet. I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is the single most significant social movement of the 20th century. I believe that. As imperfect as we are, you know, we don't do it very gracefully. We have a tendency to get a little pissy from time to time, you know. But here it is. It works. It works. It really works. It works even when we don't work it sometimes, you know. I mean, it has held me in good stead for 28 years, and there's been times where I've not done a very good job of being part of it, you know. But I've never wandered away. I've never drifted away. I've never stopped going to meetings. I've never stopped communicating with my sponsor. I've never stopped sponsoring people. I mean, the one thing that will hold you around here, that will hold you in here when all else fails, is if you've got a bunch of people that you're sponsoring, they will come and get you. You know, I mean, I have a bad liver. I need a liver transplant. I'm on a list. I'm very sick, and I end up in the hospital all the time. And these new people that I sponsor could give a shit about any of that. You know, they call up and they say, "How you doing, Bill?" And I start to tell them, and they interrupt me and start talking about themselves. So like Bob talks about, I don't have time to sit and think about me because you interrupt that process all the time. You know, there's no peace in my house. You know? But that has kept me around when there were many times I didn't want to be. You know, because I've fallen in love with you. You know, I can't do this without you. You know, if all I'm doing is going around speaking at meetings and speaking at conferences, I'm not doing AA. All I can do here is report to you about what I'm doing. And if I'm not doing anything, I'm just lying. If I'm just coming here and talking to hear myself talk, it doesn't account for much. This is not going to keep me sober. It might keep you sober, you know. If I say some really good stuff that causes you to go out and do something, maybe it will. I don't know. But at 17, you couldn't talk to me. At 17, I wasn't listening. And my story is just like everyone else's story here. I mean, the drunkalogue can be different because we come from different places. We come from different cultures and different things happen to us. Different people raised us. But every one of us, as far as I can tell, tells the same story about long before we ever drank, we felt disconnected. We didn't feel part of. We felt like the aliens had dropped us off. We're waiting for the mothership to return. You know, we would lose ourselves in books or food or something. There was some kind of addictive process that was going on long before we ever drank. But we feel this sense of separation. And we talk about that like it's some kind of unique experience. When we talk about that, we'll sometimes use this term alcoholic thinking. As if there is such a thing. I mean, Silkworth heard that phrase in the early AA meetings. In 1940, he ran off and wrote a paper about it. You can imagine him sitting in the rooms going, "Oh, geez, they're making stuff up now." You know? The only place you ever hear that term alcoholic thinking is in Alcoholics Anonymous. No one else uses that term. You know what the professional community say about us? They say, we are emotionally immature. And we hear that and we go, no. I have special thinking. I have alcoholic thinking. And it's never going away. And you need to consider that when you're dealing with me. Alcoholic thinking. You know. The difference between us and other kids that also feel that feeling, if you've ever raised teenagers, you've seen it in them. They turn about 13, they look at you, and you are the stupidest creature they've ever seen in their life. You don't understand, nor will you ever understand. And the difference between us and those other kids is we medicated that feeling and we never grew out of it. And now we show up in AA and we're going to grow up now. And the chances of us doing that and looking good are really slim. The other part of the story that's always the same is we talk about having a couple of drinks and that feeling goes away. It disappears at some level. We feel whole. All the promises come true, you know. And the fear of economic insecurity just goes right out the window. You know, I mean, we're free. All of it, we can go out and go to the party and meet her or him and have some fun. So I think that was the whole idea behind the drinking thing, if I remember correctly, was to have a couple of pops and get out of the house and go party. I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. Party! You know? And I'm having sex, menage a uno. There's no one else in the room. You know? We're partying with Billy now. It's getting serious. The next time some guy walks in here and says, "I'm just a party kind of guy," ask him, how many other people were at the party you were at? We have an odd tendency to end up completely, physically alone. Drinking and thinking. If you see an alcoholic laying in the gutter in his own piss and poop, if his eyes are open, you can bet he's got a plan. By the time I was 22 years old, I was in the Oregon State Mental Institution. I needed a little rest. It was the 60s, you know, it was hard work changing the world. And It's a great time to be a loser. We had a uniform and everything. You know, I made up so many stories about it, I don't even talk about it now because I'm not exactly sure what really happens, you know. And it was an interesting time there, and I was really in it. I was in San Francisco, and I was, you know, I was there. And by 1969, I was in a mental institution. I had met her at Bass Lake above Fresno on the 4th of July, 1966. And the Hells Angels rode in that valley, and I found my career path. I mean, that looked really good to me. I wanted to be a gunslinger, a tough guy, you know. And that's my story. I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I never went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran, and I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me, but I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. My biker nickname was Horny. I have it tattooed on my arm right here. And it's misspelled. It's H-O-R... It's H-O-R-N-E-Y. Horney. I am never going to remove that. It's a great example of my mental prowess. So we went up to Oregon. She was supposed to go live up. She lived up in Oregon. She was supposed to take the bus back, and I drove her back there. And we got married and had a couple of kids. And at 22, I was running with an outlaw motorcycle gang, and I was sticking needles in my arm every day, and I was drinking like a fish. And I wasn't coming home to that family, and they were on welfare. And we lost a house, a couple cars, jobs. We lost ourselves. It was horrible. It was horrible. And anybody else here been in a mental institution? Woo! I remember you. There's always somebody who goes, "Woo!" Party! Yeah. Well, there's a bunch of you, and there wasn't very many hands, so there's a bunch of you out there going, "Well, it really wasn't an institution. They were just observing me." I came back down to California, and I tried to get normal. The state of Oregon actually kicked me out. And there was a lot of violence, and it was really awful. You know, we laugh at that stuff because it's not like that anymore. And when it's like that, it's not funny, is it? It was awful, and I was a mess. I was at 22. I could have very easily gotten sober. I really needed you at 22 years old, but I don't remember anybody in that mental institution talking to me about recovery or AA or anything like that. They just shoot you up full of Thorazine and teach you how to walk backwards in paper slippers, you know. It's like great life skills. I was on the ward that Ken Kesey worked on when he wrote Cuckoo's Nest. They filmed it on my ward. Now, I'm not bragging. But some people went to college. This is all I got. This is it. I went up there some years ago and spoke at a convention in Salem, and I told this long ponytailed guy next to me that I was in the mental institution. He looked at me and he went, "I work there." I went, "Of course you do." And he took me and showed me around and stuff. And then since that time, I've been up there a bunch of times. And a friend of mine went up there to speak, and they made a T-shirt for me. It says, Oregon State Hospital Alumni. Yeah. I'll wear that with pride, you know. But I came back down to Los Angeles, and my sober father, who rarely preached to me, never really, him or my mother, either one. Don't make Al-Anon jokes if you don't know what it is. A lot of people make a lot of stupid Al-Anon jokes because they don't know what it is. But if you know what Al-Anon is, you can make some great Al-Anon jokes. Just stop and think of the consciousness of an individual that would live with us on purpose. What are they thinking, you know? But he let me sleep in his garage, and he gave me a job in his machine shop in El Segundo. And I tried to clean up my act. And what I did, what a lot of alcoholics did, especially alcoholics from the 60s, and, you know, Bob and I have talked about this as well. You know, I mean, one of the reasons I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I'm an alcoholic, because I quit everything else. It really wasn't that big of a deal. And I was pretty into it. But I never considered stopping drinking. Don P. used to say, he says, my drug of choice was heroin. The drug that I had no choice over whatsoever was alcohol. And that's true for me. I never attempted to stop drinking. But, you know, you got to quit shooting heroin because you can't find anybody to go along with the concept of social heroin use. There's just no support for the position. And you got to stop taking acid because normal people have two-way communication with each other. With LSD, you don't really need the other person. You just party with yourself. And I quit all that. And I met another woman because I can't ever be alone. It's a group effort getting me through life. It takes a village, you know. I met her. We set up housekeeping. We got married, and we had a couple of kids. And this was 15 years after the mental institution. I lived in the house with that woman, that wife of mine, and those two small children, and I had no emotional connection to another living human being. And I didn't know that. I didn't know it was that bad. The alcoholic life seems like the only normal one to me because it's the only one I've ever known. It wasn't like I had a life. And then I started drinking and it all went to hell and I'm trying to recapture what I once had. I never had a life. So the alcoholic life is the only thing I know. I can't stand outside myself and have a separate experience and then compare it to the one that I'm having to determine that there's anything wrong. I think I'm connected to you. You live in the same house with me. Physically, we're close. We're in proximity to each other. But I don't know that I have no emotional connection to you. I've never been connected. How would I know that there was something missing? But at 37, there I was. And up to this point, evidently, this was the end. And I got drunk one more night, stayed up all night, nothing special, nothing particular crazy happened, you know, and just the sun comes up one more time and you know it's going to be another miserable day. You know, we don't need any other proof that alcoholism is physiological other than that last 3 to 5 years that you and I were out there. There's no party. There's no party. There's no rock and roll. There's no hip dope. There's nothing cool happening. I'm just surviving the day. I'm getting through the day. It's maintenance drinking. I'm drunk from the neck down. There's no more mental and emotional relief. You ever drank yourself clear? Boy, that was never the idea, was it? You tell people that it stopped working, they think you're joking. But it stops. I mean, aspects of it, man, it would kill the physical pain that I felt. But I reached a point in my drinking you were still there. I'm drinking for the blackout. I never crossed a line. I didn't know there was a line. I mean, I started drinking at 15. It became a lifestyle immediately. And I lived like that for 22, 23 years. Even when I tried to clean up my act, there was always something in my system. You know, I mean, I need something in me all the time to cushion the blow of you on me. I can't deal with you with just naked blood. I don't know. I can't do it. I don't get along. I don't interact well. I have rage. And the only thing that quells the rage is the alcohol. And you take that away from me and I'm a mess. And so like any good gangster, I called my mom. Next time you see some big badass looking guy walk in here, ask him, do you live with your mom? Chances are. Al-Anons are prepared. She was ready. She was there inside of a half an hour. Because you know, when we make that call, if we lay down and take a nap, everything changes. You wouldn't want to rush into anything, you know. And she came and got me. Checked me into a place in Costa Mesa called Starting Point. And I spent 35 days in there. Now, I should tell you that I went to my first shrink when I was 13 years old because of the rage. I was just out of control. I would have rage seizures. And I spent a year and a half with this guy, and he helped me. And he introduced me to my favorite subject, me. That lifelong pursuit of self, you know. And I spent two tours of duty in the mental institution and went back for a follow-up. And this was a locked-down barbed wire on the top. This is a nut house. It was cool. You know, you have some sparkling conversations in the mental institution. It's a great place to look for a bride. I spent 2.5 years in group therapy at one time. I've been to several other therapists and psychiatrists over the years. I've been gestalted and rolfed and primal screamed. I know more about myself than is safe to know. And, so while I was in this hospital program, this recovery program for 35 days, they made me wear a sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. We made it in crafts. This little rectangular piece of cardboard with a string that went through it, and it said, I am not a counselor. Because evidently there was some confusion. And after 35 days, they let me out. They just let us out, don't they? Like we're okay. You know? Go forth, multiply. And where do we end up? Here. This is it. This is the world's aftercare program. Did you know there's no referrals from AA? Did you know that? There's no place you go where you walk in and you say, I'm from AA. They sent me here. That place doesn't exist. The inmates are running the asylum. You know? We are the counselors. Now stop and think about this. I've been to a mental institution twice, and I've been married 3 times. And people ask me for relationship advice. I give it to them. I figure, hell, you can't hurt them. They're in AA. You know? And plus the fact, stop and think about it. Whatever advice I give them couldn't possibly be worse than what they're planning on doing anyway. So now I'm a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I walk in here. This is it. You know. What up? You hear a lot of stuff, man. You know, this whole thing about losing our edge, I think we're better now. I think we're as vibrant and effective as we've ever been. You know, I really believe that. I think we understand alcoholism a hell of a lot better than we did. I think a lot that has been brought into AA from the professional community is good. A lot of it isn't. A lot of it I don't agree with. You know, it's hard for them to grasp the idea of a spiritually based program. But they're coming around. They're coming around. The psychotherapists now are actually talking and writing books about this spiritual aspect of human nature, treating it as if it exists. It's a real entity, and I believe that. I think you and I have experienced that. And two things happened to me when I got here that I feel real lucky about. One is, I just liked it. Fairly quickly, I just liked it. Like you, like any of us, I really didn't want to be here. It wasn't the plan. But it didn't take me very long to just like it. You know, I got the humor right away. I liked the people right away. That was to change later. But I got intrigued. I was intrigued by it right away. I actually got intrigued on it in the hospital program. They had us read the book and stuff, and it made sense to me. I got it, you know. I mean, the God thing was stupid, so you just ignore that, you know. And that's easy enough to do. Even to this day, I don't believe God is an issue in AA. It's not an issue. We try to make it one, but it just isn't. It's an experience that we have. It's not a concept that we have to develop. It'll happen to us. If you stick around here and you do the work, it'll happen. It happens to everybody. And it gets to the point where you can't ignore it. You can't deny it because you have the experience of it. You can avoid the experience of it, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But the second thing that happened is I asked this man for help, and he actually helped me. I showed up at his house every Thursday at 5 o'clock and read a chapter in the book, and he guided me through the steps. And he said things to me that made AA very clear to me, that I found out later, not everybody feels this way. I feel so fortunate that this happened to me. He said to me, he says, my job as your sponsor is to guide you through the process of the 12 steps that you might have an spiritual experience that will change you, to change your perception of the world around you that maybe you'll never ever drink again. I would be happy to sit here and listen to what you think your problems are so that you will not share about them in the meetings. He said, the meetings are for recovery from alcoholism, not about how your day went. I immediately informed him that down at the Alano Club, they were breaking that rule right and left. Should we go tell them? And he said, no. He says, AA is a safe place. You can come here and share whatever you want. You can pretty much do almost anything you want to do. He says, I'm just describing to you my Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God I didn't get somebody that has bought into this weird concept that we don't express opinions or give advice. You know, if we didn't do those two things, we wouldn't have anything to say to each other. You know? And I'm a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need some good advice. You know, and I was married at the time, and a couple, 3 months sober, my wife came home and said, I'd like you to stay home on Tuesday night so I can go to an Al-Anon meeting. I couldn't believe she even asked me that. And I told her, I don't babysit. And I just walked out of the house. And I felt perfectly justified in that. I thought she had really overstepped her bounds. And I made the mistake of telling my sponsor. Thank God he didn't quote a page number to me. Tell me to go read something, you know. He rarely yelled at me, but on this particular occasion he said, "It's not babysitting, they're your children." Now you go back there and with a smile on your face, you tell that woman you would be happy to watch your children while she tries to find recovery in the Al-Anon family groups. So I went home and I said, "I'd be happy to him." And the first Tuesday night, the little boy is like 1 year old. He just passed out. I don't know what I thought he was going to do. But, you know, I don't like kids. I mean, I'm afraid of them. You know? They're more self-centered than me. It's competition. You know? I can have them and stuff, but I don't really want to do anything with them, you know. They don't talk right, you know. It's just flame, you know. And my three-year-old daughter, you know, she wanted to watch a little TV or play something, so we did that, you know. And then the next week went by, and she didn't want to watch TV. She wanted to go outside and throw the ball around and this and that. And the weeks went by, and the months went by. And I began to develop a relationship with these kids. And one night after about 6-8 months, she comes home and she says, "Well, I'm not going to my Al-Anon meeting tonight." And I said, "Well, you better go somewhere. This is my night with the kids." Isn't that how it works? You know? The worst thing you can possibly say to anybody in AA is take what you can use and leave the rest. That'll kill people. That kind of thing will kill people. Because you're going to allow me with this finely tuned instrument to determine what is good for me? When have I ever shown a propensity towards making good value judgments in the past? You know? When? Tell me when. You know, where's the backup evidence to this, you know? I mean, I need somebody to sit down and talk to me like a man and really tell me what to do. In a finger pointing in the chest kind of way. No, I don't know that really. I mean, there might be some idiots that actually do that, but I think it's more how we take it than what really is happening. I mean, this man just gave me good, solid, practical advice. He wasn't telling me to do weird stuff or ordering me around, and if I didn't do it, he was going to fire me or anything like that. It wasn't anything like that, you know. I mean, you don't fire them. That's how you learn patience and tolerance, is keeping the weirdos around. You know what I mean? You exercise that muscle, you know. You can pray for his death, but don't say it to him. You know? So here's what I think's going on here, for whatever it's worth. Just the first step says that we're powerless. Now, they took it easy on us and just said that we were powerless over alcohol because they didn't want us to go screaming down the street, you know. And my experience of 28 years, for whatever that's worth, is that I think I am completely and utterly and absolutely powerless over anything. I am not of the school that believes that now that I'm sober, I've been re-empowered and given the power of choice back. It just simply, I understand that, but it has not been my experience. I think I am completely powerless. And whenever I get the idea that I have some power, that is the source of all the suffering in my life. It comes from that inability to accept around me the way things actually are. I think they should be different. I judge things. We all judge things, don't we? We look out and we say, "Well, that event was good. That was a good thing. I got the money." You know? And then something else, we look at it, "Well, that was a bad thing." Well, in nature, if you look out in nature, there's no good or bad. There's no morality play. Things simply are. The lion eats the lamb every time. And we think the lion, the big, mean, evil lion, shouldn't eat the lamb. And just because we believe that, it changes nothing. The lion continues to eat the lamb. And he doesn't understand that he shouldn't do that he should be vegan. He just doesn't get it. We try and talk to him, you know. And, you know, whenever he comes across a lamb, he, you know, it's over. Yeah. So then we say, "Well, we can't seem to change this, so we'll have hope. We'll create hope. And we'll make a parable up that says there will come a time in the future when things are good, because things are really bad right now. The present moment is not correct. It's incorrect. But there will come a time where the lion will lay down with the lamb. Now, if that occurs, I'll bet you that lamb will be nervous for eternity. It is the nature of the lion to eat the lamb. And there's no right or wrong to it. And we just have a difficult time with all that stuff. Me included. In life, there is pain. We lose people. People leave us. People hurt us. People die. Stuff happens. We lose our homes. We lose all our money. Stuff happens. And we're sad. And we feel the pain of that loss. I believe that's a natural thing. You and I, as alcoholics, whenever we feel pain, we think there's something incorrect that needs to be repaired immediately. You know, and we've been doing that most of our lives, medicating that so that we never feel bad. So now we're sober. Whenever we feel bad, well, we're not working a good enough program, or so we come up with something. Something's wrong that needs to be fixed. Pain, I think, is part of life. Suffering, on the other hand, truly is optional. And what we do when that painful thing happens is we make the determination that it should not have occurred. That it was unfair, unjust. Now we've created the suffering. And that suffering will last much longer than the pain of the event itself. This is called resentment. Resentment to me really is kind of a first step thing. I am utterly powerless. And my judgments are completely irrelevant. It says that my life became unmanageable. It alludes to the fact that maybe at one time it was manageable. I don't remember that time. I think my life does not need to be managed. I think the next indicated thing is obvious. The alarm goes off, get up. You know, it just unfolds right in front of me all the time. The universe, by its very nature, is a giving entity. I just take exception to what it's giving. I think it should be different than it is. I suffer. If as a newcomer in AA I could grasp this powerlessness just a little bit, just the drugs and alcohol part, just that little bit, if I can grasp that, if I can cop to it, the second step then becomes operational. I need to align myself with the power. I need to be restored to sanity, certainly enough sanity not to drink and use, but also enough sanity to be able to glimpse the powerlessness. This is the beginning of acceptance. If I can do that, the third step becomes operational. Now, the third step's interesting. We're going to turn our life and will over to what already has it anyway. I think it was nice of them to lead us to believe that there's something we could actually do in the third step. But isn't that the classic alcoholic position? There's the universe and me. That's impossible. I am not, nor could I ever be, separate from nature. That's literally impossible. We talk all the time about the difference between my will and God's will. Isn't that the height of arrogance? The idea that you and I could do battle of wills with the power that drives the entire universe? You know? Well, I've been withholding myself from the totality of all things long enough. I'm going to acquiesce now and allow you to take me. Thank you very much. What life and will is it talking about? The inventory, the resentments, fears, and broken relationships. The end result of living a life with seeming power. Evidently, my happiness is dependent upon your behavior because I spend an inordinate amount of time trying to adjust you so that we can both be happier. You know? And you resent that, and I resent you. You insist upon living your own life, and it pisses me off at my core. I will carry this to my grave. Fear? Of course I have fear, because this isn't working and I have no plan B. So I hate you and I'm afraid of you at the same time. Broken relationships, the sex list, some people call it. What other kind of relationships could I have but dramatic and traumatic ones if what I'm bringing to the table is resentment and fear? Where do you suppose that's going to end up? Married bliss? You know? The fifth step is a ceremony that we go through to complete the third step. We physically and literally turn it over to someone else. We make that list, we make the columns, and we tell this other person, ourselves, and the manager, this power, here's my stuff, I'm pooped, you take it. Six and seven are two paragraphs in the book, there's nothing to do, and we'll be doing that nothing for the rest of our lives. You know? You can see what the defects of character are, or the shortcomings. They're in the fourth column of the resentment list. It says, what were my faults and mistakes? Not my part. It says, what were my faults and mistakes? It's a different animal. I think the way we address those comes later, but we can certainly become willing. We can certainly, for the first time in our lives, maybe begin to take responsibility for our own behavior and stop blaming those other people. Come to realize, ultimately, it truly, honestly, never is them. It's never them, but boy, it sure looks like them. I mean, it's a hard one, because sometimes it's just them, man, you know. And, a friend of mine I got sober with had a tragedy in his life, and his sponsor and I were talking, and his sponsor said to me, he says, I went over and I disarmed him. And I said, what do you mean? He was packing? He goes, yeah, he had two guns on him. And I go, why was he carrying two guns? He goes, because they're after him. And I said, who is? And he looked at me like I'm an idiot. And he goes, don't you know who they are? And I went, oh, yeah. 8 and 9, the manager gives us our first job. He says, make amends. I'm going to help rid you of the resentments. The mechanism for ridding ourselves of resentments is the amends process. The biggest problem I have in my life today is not the defects of character that are so obvious you can see them. Most of us, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. But they're the aspects of me that were never developed. That's what the psychotherapeutic community wants me to do, is go back and find that good little Billy that I've suppressed. I don't believe he's there. I don't think he ever developed. I never grew up, literally. I never grew up. And one of the things I don't have is compassion. I can't feel you in my life. And the offshoots of compassion are patience and tolerance. If I'm compassionate towards you, I will automatically be patient and tolerant with you because I feel you. I get it. I understand it. And in AA, isn't there that strange connection between the two of us? When somebody asks for help and you sit down with them and you're reading the book with them and you're sharing your life, you connect with them. More so than people in your own family or your wife or your husband. You just connect, we just connect with each other. We get it. I get the pain. I felt the pain and I do truly feel your pain. And we begin to exercise that compassion muscle every time we do that. If we don't do the one-on-one thing, it never happens. You know, it never happens. Don't ever mistake activity for action. You know, General Service is great. Central Service is great. H&I is great. It's all great stuff. I've done it all. I love the AA community, but don't ever mistake the activity for the action. Nothing will affect us more powerfully than one-on-one work with another alcoholic. At the end of the ninth step, am I capable of intimacy? No. It's sober 101. It's about 15% of the program max. And we agonize over it, don't we? I mean, we have seminars and stuff, and I've done it all too. I've done step workshops, and I understand all that. But it's sober 101. It's the bare beginning. It's the stuff that we have to do to develop a message that has depth and weight that we can then start to do the real program. 10, 11, and 12 are not maintenance steps. There's nothing to maintain. This thing is not about drinking. That's over. It's about giving back. It's about getting out of ourselves. It's about being relieved of the bondage of self. Thank God it's over. You know? I don't have to work on me anymore. I tell you, at this point in my life, at 65 years old, I am absolutely bored to tears with myself. I mean, there is just no stone left unturned. I mean, how much more can I think about my... I mean, I do it, but it kind of makes me ill. You know, because I know it's a dead-end street. Who cares, you know? Who cares? I'm much better off when I'm with you. You bring me out of myself, and that is the healing process. 10 is the continuing inventory process. It's about self-awareness of what happened to me in 85 as I was awakened. The rest of the journey is to take that awakening and turn it into some kind of an awareness where I'm actually aware that I'm awake. And maybe there's something I can do with this. Maybe there's a reason I'm here. Maybe there's a job for me. Maybe there's something bigger than me going on. What do you think? I suspect maybe. 11 is about sucking up to the manager. You know? It would behoove me to try to get close to whatever it is, save my life. Something touched me. And my opinion about that is absolutely irrelevant. Alan Watts said one of the most powerful things I've ever heard in my life. He said, faith is not knowing and having that be okay. And he said, think about that. You have to think about that. It is a profound thing. Faith to me always was, I create a belief mechanism and I have faith that that belief mechanism is correct. What he's saying is something even more powerful. Faith is truly not knowing and accepting that. That everything is always as it should be all the time. That's faith to me. And I believe that. I have faith in that. The evidence is astounding that everything is as it is. You know? In meditation, the 11th step, you can watch your thoughts. What you do in meditation, a basic meditation, is you sit, you close your eyes, take two or three big deep breaths, and then focus your thinking, your mind, on the breath going in and out of your nose. And your mind will wander. That's what it does. It wanders. It has no desire whatsoever to be in the present moment. There's nothing for it to do. Okay? So it wanders away. And you catch it. You realize. You become aware that you're no longer focused on the breath, and you gently bring it back to the breath. Now, who is doing the catching? Good question, huh? Well, one thing is for sure, beyond a shadow of a doubt, conclusive proof, I am not my thinking mind. Because if I was, I couldn't catch it. You know? Now, it thinks it's me. And I think it's me too. I'm in collusion with it. And in AA, we say things, we talk about it in the third person, don't we? We say, my head's out to get me. Of course, we make it adversarial, you know, it's like, it's who we are. And I don't think it's out to get me. Why would it kill the host? Well, you know, I think it's trying to help, it's just stupid. Capable of doing is taking the past and projecting it into the future. That's all it does. They were looking for you then, they're looking for you now. It's them. You know? That's all it's doing. Now, once I realize that, that changes the whole game. I don't need to analyze it, I don't need to work on it, I don't need to share it with anybody that crosses my path. I can simply ignore the damn thing. Just ignore it. And every time it acts up, especially if there's anxiety or fear or something like that, when it gets really nasty, I can stop and breathe and watch my breath and it goes away. It can't stand to be observed and it shrinks off into the shadows and it waits for you to not be looking again and it comes back. And the only time it has anything to do is in the future or in the past. When you're in the present moment, there's no necessity for it at all. Because you're right here, right now, and that is all there is. The 12th step is where it all comes home. The 12th step is why we're here. The 12th step is why we did all the previous work, is to prepare ourselves for the work. Should everybody sponsor people? Absolutely. There's nothing else to do. You know? I mean, you can pretend that you could make up for that by doing other things, but I've yet to find anything that will have the impact on any of us more than that. And we tell ourselves all kinds of lies. Well, you know, I don't have anything to offer. It's not what I do here. I do other things. You ever heard somebody say, the way I do my 12-step work is I keep showing up to meetings, I sit in the same chair so that when the people come in, they feel comfortable seeing me there. I go, really? That's what you do? But I judge no man. I got trained early that this is what we're here for. This is what we do. There's two rules I live by, and I try very diligently to live by these. Sometimes I fall short, but most of the time I'm pretty good at it, because I have to paint myself in a corner for this experience to happen for me. If I start thinking about it, I will determine that there's places I don't want to go, things I don't want to do. Always answer the phone. Get rid of caller ID. Don't screen the calls. Frightening, isn't it? Have faith that whoever's calling you is supposed to be in your life. Have faith. And we talk about faith all the time. We talk about trusting in God. Trust God. Carry the message. Trust God. Well, trust his ass. You know, it's how he gets in touch with us. He calls. When I get on my knees and ask for help, he sends me you. He sends me you all the time, constantly. I get it now. I get it. You're bringing the message to me. You are the catalyst for change in my life. It's obvious to me now. I don't know why I couldn't see it for years. All the service work, all the sponsoring I did for years was based upon my ego, because I was rapidly working hard at trying to make a name for myself in an anonymous organization. I have no idea what that is, but it's very weird. And it's okay, you can do that, it's all right. Your motivation is completely irrelevant if you're actually doing the work, because you'll crash and burn. I crashed and burned several times. And rule number two, never say no. When they ask you to do something, do it. Don't question it. Have faith that whatever you're being asked to do is where you're supposed to be, what you're supposed to be doing. And I've been living like that for a long time, and I'm here to report to you it is an incredibly abundant, rich life. Incredibly. Is it inconvenient? Absolutely. You know? I mean, my wife sponsors a lot of girls. I sponsor a lot of guys. We try to keep them separated, you know? She actually tries to set them up, which is not good. You know, she'll come to me and she'll say, that guy Jack, is he okay? And I go, no, Karen, none of them are okay. You know? And all these young kids that come in, you got to feed them. They never have any money. You know, it's like, and she feeds them. She loves them. She feeds them. You know, we have that house. I live in a house like the one I was raised in. It's come full circle. You know, there was a healing between my parents and I, and they watched me live this same life that they lived. I feel incredibly fortunate for that to have occurred. The last 15 years of his life, my dad and I gave each other birthday cakes in the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. And I found my father in AA. I fell in love with my father in AA. If you open your heart to this work, I guarantee you something. If you open your heart to this, maybe you'll leave inspired tonight. Maybe you've been around a while and you're not sponsoring anything. Well, maybe I should get involved in this. I hope I can instill that in you. I hope it presses a button. I hope it pisses you off enough to where you start talking to some other people about it and get off your ass and do something, you know? I really do. I wish that for you. And if you open your heart to this work, whatever prejudice you have will walk across the room and ask you for help. Guaranteed. Guaranteed. I promise you, that will occur. And then you have a choice. If you want to hang on to the prejudice, if you want to hang on to the arrogance, if you want to hang on to the opinions, send it away. And you can find a lot of support for that in AA. There's people that will help you send it away. We don't work with this kind of person or that kind of person. Just, you can get support for that. I didn't meet those people. I was told I could never say no. This guy walked up to me and he said, "Will you sponsor me? I think I should tell you I'm gay." And I go, "Wouldn't you rather have a gay sponsor?" He looked right at me and he goes, "No," he says, "I don't have a problem being gay, but drinking is an issue." Who knew? Who knew? I used to stand up at these podiums and I'd say that if you were on medication, you weren't sober. I didn't know anything about that, but I don't require any knowledge to form an opinion. I could just kind of do it on the fly, and I heard some of you say that, and it seemed like a really good badass opinion to have, so I just started doing it. Sure enough, this guy walks up to me and he says, "Will you sponsor me? I'm bipolar and I'm on medication." I went, "Jeez." But I can't say no. It's not up to me to decide. You know, it's not up to me. I don't care what your problem is. I'll work with you. Many times it doesn't work out. But maybe you need to hang on to me for a while until you find the right person to be with. You know, I don't know why you're here in AA. You know, there's a lot of people here in AA, I don't think, that are alcoholic and they're here for one reason or another. And I have opinions about that, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what my opinion is. When anyone, anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to be there for that. I'm responsible. And, you know, I can't fix you. I can't be your therapist. I can't be. There's a lot of stuff I can't be. You know, with these kids, you know, some of them, they want a father figure. You know, I can do that for a while. I like the part when they love you and they think you're really wise. And then they wise up and they realize you've stolen all this from someone else, you know. There's some real sweet parts of it, and I've also come to realize I'm not a father figure, I'm a grandfather figure. And so, you know. So I start working the steps with this guy, and I had the experience of peeling him off the ceiling and lifting him off the floor, you know. One time he came across my living room, 40-year-old grown man, curls up in my lap, put his head in my neck, and just cried like a baby at the pain of his life. Just the pain of being alive. And I just held him and rocked him, you know. Karen walked through the living room. She goes, "Whoa." I mean, that'll get your attention. You know, I was like, "Jeez." And now when I see that guy coming, I go, "Have you taken your medication, man? You got issues, dude." Now, you know, I think all newcomers are bipolar. And the whole medical profession wants to medicate us, and I don't agree with that. I think it's overused. There's a lot of stuff I don't agree with. But if you come and ask me for help, I am not arrogant enough to turn you away. I won't do that. I'll be mean to you. You know, it doesn't mean I'm going to be sweet. You know, I might tell you some stuff you don't want to hear. You know, if you come in and you want to change my Alcoholics Anonymous to make yourself more comfortable, I will beat you with sticks and stuff, you know. I mean, you're sitting in my backyard, we can talk about anything. You know, but if you want to try to change AA or you want to argue, like these guys get to the third step with a guy, and the guy, I said, "Are you ready to do the third step?" He says, "No." I said, "Why not?" He says, "Because I have a problem with God." And I look right at him and I say, "Me too, let's pray." You know? That's like the whole argument, like all the air goes out of the balloon, you know? I had a couple of guys say, "Well, I don't even believe in God." I look right at him, I go, "Nobody really does, let's pray." You know? I mean, I concur, brother. It's a stupid idea. But it says right here in this book, pray. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm an AA. This place is not hip. It's going to make me do lame stuff. But I've been around long enough to where it works. My sponsor has told me several times, "Bill, you will be reduced to prayer and meditation." And I have been reduced. to prayer and meditation. When you find yourself in a hospital over and over again and you don't want to be there, you're powerless. And I've been put in a position where I've had to ask for help and not of the human kind. I've had to get quiet, close my eyes, and breathe deeply and say, please help me. Help me. And it hasn't changed my physical condition, but it has changed my attitude. It's opened up meditation to me. I mean, it took me 20 years before I really got into this stuff. You know, really started doing something with it that was real in my life rather than just head knowledge. And it incorporated into my breast, and it has changed my life. We have a very, very merciful entity looking over us. He's been very merciful with me. He's changed my life. I can't describe the depth of what my life has changed with me being unwilling. You know, with me being driven totally by ego for years and years until that finally just leaked out of me. I'll leave you with this. You'll hear people in AA say, you got to give it away to keep it. No. You've got to give it away to even get it. If you're not giving it away, you don't have it. Thank you.